falling. After the burst of excitement that accompanied the release of Macintosh, its sales began to taper off in the second half of 1984. The problem was a fundamental one. It was a dazzling but woefully slow and underpowered computer, and no amount of hoopla could mask that. Its beauty was that its user interface looked like a sunny playroom rather than a somber dark screen with sickly green pulsating letters and surly command lines. But that led to its greatest weakness. A character on a text-based display took less than a byte of code, whereas when the Mac drew a letter, pixel by pixel, in any elegant font you wanted, it required 20 or 30 times more memory. The Lisa handled this by shipping with more than 1,000K RAM, whereas the Macintosh made do with 128K. Another problem was the lack of an internal hard disk drive. Jobs had called Joanna Hoffman a Xerox bigot when she fought for such a storage device. He insisted that the Macintosh have just one floppy disk drive. If you wanted to copy data, you could end up with a new form of tennis elbow from having to swap floppy disks in and out of the single drive. In addition, the Macintosh lacked a fan, another example of Jobs's dogmatic stubbornness. Fans, he felt, detracted from the calm of a computer. This caused many component failures and earned the Macintosh the nickname the Beige Toaster, which did not enhance its popularity. It was so seductive that it had sold well enough for the first few months, but when people became more aware of its limitations, sales fell. As Hoffman later lamented, the reality distortion field can serve as a spur, but then reality itself hits. At the end of 1984, with Lisa sales virtually non-existent and Macintosh sales falling below 10,000 a month, Jobs made a shoddy and atypical decision out of desperation. He decided to take the inventory of unsold Lisas, graft on a Macintosh emulation program, and sell them as a new product, the Macintosh XL. Since the Lisa had been discontinued and would not be restarted, it was an unusual instance of Jobs producing something that he did not believe in. "I was furious because the Mac XL wasn't real," said Hoffman. "It was just to blow the excess Lisas out the door. It sold well, and then we had to discontinue the horrible hoax, so I resigned." The dark mood was evident in the ad that was developed in January 1985, which was supposed to reprise the anti-IBM sentiment of the resonant 1984 ad. Unfortunately, there was a fundamental difference. The first ad had ended on a heroic, optimistic note, but the storyboards presented by Lee Clow and Jay Shiat for the new ad, titled Lemmings, showed dark-suited, blindfolded corporate managers marching off a cliff to their death. From the beginning, both Jobs and Scully were uneasy. It didn't seem as if it would convey a positive or glorious image of Apple, but instead would merely insult every manager who had bought an IBM. Jobs and Scully asked for other ideas, but the agency folks pushed back. "You guys didn't want to run 1984 last year," one of them said. According to Scully, Lee Clow added, "I will put my whole reputation, everything, on this commercial." When the filmed version, done by Ridley Scott's brother Tony, came in, the concept looked even worse. The mindless managers marching off the cliff were singing a funeral-paced version of the Snow White song, "Hi Ho, Hi Ho," and the dreary filmmaking made it even more depressing than the storyboards portended. "I can't believe you're going to insult business people across America by running that," Debbie Coleman yelled at Jobs when she saw the ad. At the marketing meetings, she stood up to make her point about how much she hated it. "I literally put a resignation letter on his desk. I wrote it on my Mac. I thought it was an affront to corporate managers. We were just beginning to get a toehold with desktop publishing." Nevertheless, Jobs and Scully bent to the agency's entreaties and ran the commercial during the Super Bowl. They went to the game together at Stanford Stadium with Scully's wife, Leezy, who couldn't stand Jobs, and Jobs' new girlfriend, Tina Redzi. When the commercial was shown near the end of the fourth quarter of a dreary game, the fans watched on the overhead screen and had little reaction. Across the country, most of the response was negative. It insulted the very people Apple was trying to reach, the president of a market research firm told Fortune. Apple's marketing manager suggested afterward that the company might want to buy an ad in the Wall Street Journal apologizing. Jay Chiat threatened that if Apple did that, his agency would buy the facing page and apologize for the apology. Jobs' discomfort with both the ad and the situation at Apple in general was on display when he traveled to New York in January to do another round of one-on-one press interviews. Andy Cunningham from Regis McKenna's firm was in charge of handholding and logistics at the Carlyle. When Jobs arrived, he told her that his suite needed to be completely redone, even though it was 10 p.m. and the meetings were to begin the next day. The piano was not in the right place. The strawberries were the wrong type. But his biggest objection was that he didn't like the flowers. He wanted calla lilies. "We got into a big fight on what a calla lily is," Cunningham recalled. "I know what they are, because I had them at my wedding, but he insisted on having a different type of lily and said I was stupid because I didn't know what a real calla lily was." So Cunningham went out, and this being New York, was able to find a place open at midnight where she could get the lilies he wanted. By the time they got the room rearranged, Jobs started objecting to what she was wearing. "That suit's disgusting," he told her. Cunningham knew that at times he just simmered with undirected anger, so she tried to calm him down. "Look, I know you're angry, and I know how you feel," she said. "You have no fucking idea how I feel," he shot back. "No fucking idea what it's like to be me."